rabbiting on.
Oh, that's nice. Rabbiting. I always like it when Miriam sings.
Gary started singing that last night. I was really touched that he even knew it.
I saw that Ellen Allard put on Facebook that we had used her song last time. I was very excited to get the shout out.
It was very cute.
Very exciting.
Rabbiting on. Rabbiting on.
Welcome to Rabbiting On. Rabbiting On.
Rabbiting On.
It is lovely to be together. This is our 36th episode of Rabbiting On, which feels a very auspicious number for us. And our last one of series two. No. Sad faces. Yeah. We're hoping for a series three. We'll keep you updated about what's happening. But this
can
is
we
our
lobby
final
the,
episode.
Can we lobby RJ, please?
Yes. Please send your emails and texts to the Movement for Reform Judaism to lobby for season three.
Yay.
Yay. So we thought we'd start our last episode of season two with how we start every pre-meet to our podcast, which is we do a sound check, and producer Dan always asks us the same question and we answer exactly the same each time. What did you have for breakfast? Well, there, so Miriam,
this morning's was a revelation. I mean, I can't quite get over Debbie's new breakfast product, which I think, it's Mother's Day on Sunday. I'm just wondering whether Johnny and Ben might have like heard this episode before then, because basically,
do you want me to text them?
Well, I have a policy that everything's better in a wrap. Okay. But
no, in a rap, like in a rap R-A-P or in a W-R-A-P?
Definitely not an R-A-P
rap,
because
I
was thrown out of the brownies for turning the brownie promise into a rap. So I have an issue with that kind of rap. But I do think any food product put in a tortilla wrap just is elevated. But Debbie might have a whole different, I mean, today's revelation was just like a whole different, Debbie, you have to share it with the listeners.
So I don't know how much appropriate product placement we're allowed. I know this isn't the Beeb, so we're okay. But I discovered a few months ago, I've kind of been slowly buying them for my girlfriends. I might have to just send them to you guys. They're called Crimpets. And it's basically a little plastic box, and they are designed to fit in the little sandwich thins that you can get that are kind of meant to be like a low-fat way of eating a bit of bread. So you put the bottom of your square sandwich thin into the box, and then you pick your filling. It could be, I mean, my kids love a bit of Nutella, or they'll have peanut butter and cheese, or as Robin so often has on her crumpets, a bit of peanut butter and Marmite. Yay. Or Marmite and cheese, or Miriam apparently wants to go for tuna and cheese. But
to be honest, I'm actually a cheese and beans kind of girl, but I'm worried
But let's, you see what you think. So you put your bottom bit in, you put your filling in the middle, put the top of the sandwich thin on, and then the top of the box has these little ridges, and you put it on top of everything, crimp the edges, and you end up with a little sort of almost like a giant ravioli shaped sandwich thin with the filling in the middle. Pop it in the toaster.
Now I want ricotta and spinach in there.
Pocket. It's absolutely delicious and clever. It does occasionally pop open. So we Hence might now the- have a cheesy, milky toaster, which has upset everyone. But it's really good. Didn't have one today, but it is really good.
It's like taking Breville to a whole other level, because you don't need an extra device on your work surface.
You're rapping and you don't even know it. Breville to another level. You see, you can't help yourself.
I reckon that, you know, all these companies will just go, you're wasted in the rabbinate. You need to come and do our PR.
And with a sandwich toaster like Breville, I'm sure other devices are available.
Although there's only really one.
Made by Tower. I always put sort of oil or butter a bit on the outside so it gets a nice sort of crispy finish. So in a way, the crimpet's much healthier because I'm not buttering the outside.
Especially once you put Nutella in the middle. You could always have some nice marshmallows in there too to make up for the fact that you haven't put on the outside.
Nuts are protein. They're good for you.
We definitely missed a trick. This could have been a whole episode of
maybe
what we would recommend for breakfast. I'm learning a lot.
Yeah.
I have the same breakfast every breakfast, but maybe I should get
What do you have for breakfast, Robin? Share with the nation.
I always have a crumpet double toasted, although I have found a toaster that you can put like a crumpet setting on. It was the best crumpet I ever had.
You do have to really cook them well, don't you? They're much better when they're
really
well
done. So two toasted crumpet with peanut butter crunchy, no palm oil. That's ethical peanut butter crunchy with a bit of Marmite on top. Beautiful. It's lovely. And some raspberries sometimes on the side if I'm being fancy.
I have an amazing friend who is originally German but lived in London for some years and then moved out to Texas. And she missed crumpets so much that her Texan husband made them for her from scratch.
Wow. Oh my gosh.
Which is astonishing devotion. I used to have friends bring them out to me when I lived in Sweden. They would literally have half their hand luggage was crumpets for me to put in the freezer.
Although that always
the king of all foods.
That reminds me of our trip to America together, Debbie, when we were coming back through customs. We'd been in America at a conference for mikveh builders. Obviously, the conference that you'd expect two rabbits to be at. And we get to security to check in to come home. And
bearing in mind that we had both managed incredibly accurate weighing of our main luggage, bang on 23 kilos. I was very proud of that.
It's all true. We get to security and they ask Debbie to open her hand luggage suitcase, like one of the mini roll, you know, wheelie along bags. At which point she opens it up and it is full of kosher food that you can only buy in America that you can't buy in England.
And mostly absolute rubbish. It was like, so... I've been asked to bring dill pickle chips back for someone at the office and Reese's Pieces, and it was all absolute trash food. And it was so, I'm like, the fat woman is standing there with all this trash food.
It was quite the image.
So embarrassed. I must have turned puce.
It was definitely quite the image. I'm a bit worried that we're not going to talk about anything of any value today, but it's nice for us to just be able to
have this. This is value.
Let's ignore the script. Because we don't want to do
it. It's just because you're not a breakfast person.
I feel like we're doing the equivalent of Gary Lineker. Rather than saying, like, okay, well, none of the pundits will be at Rabbiting On, we're saying you've given us a topic that's just too difficult. And so we're just going to keep avoiding the topic.
So we're going to talk about breakfast.
Talking about anything else.
Yeah. There we go. We've let everyone into our little secrets of sound check and our very intricate conversations about breakfast. But if we've had 36 episodes, we've had 36 conversations about breakfast, all of which have been very interesting.
All of which have included Robin's crumpet with peanut butter and Marmite.
And it still took till last week for Miriam to realise that they were actually being served together.
Well,
yeah. I know, it's a revelation.
It was just a hard concept for me to think of those things and going on the same crumpet. I just assumed it involved two crumpets with a different topping on each.
No, I mean, I've got a lot more to say about Marmite and peanut butter, but we'll save that for season three.
Also, it could be a good post-Pesach carb fest.
Miriam's not great. Letting it go.
Because like, it is, you know, anything that involves a crumpet and Marmite and peanut butter after Pesach is like your, what do you do for Pesach, Robin?
Being a vegan at Pesach, Ashkenazi vegan, it's not easy.
No. Vegetables.
No, it isn't. Lots of vegetables. Mm. Yeah. Right. We should get... Not an easy one to lead, this one, is it?
Every time
topic-wise, every time I try,
we're gonna keep pulling you
one
off.
Of you keeps pulling us off track. I mean, it's understandable that talking about this topic is hard. It's hard within communities. It's hard doing it publicly. It's actually hard having this conversation around the family, you know, Friday night table, because conversations have got so polarized. We're talking about Israel and Palestine, of course. Conversations get so polarized. People's emotions are so heightened. And we all seem to come with such different narratives and language around the conflict and our relationship to it, that talking about it can be really hard. But that doesn't mean that it's not important to talk about, and that it isn't Aleinu upon us to just start to talk about the hardness, why it's difficult, how it's difficult, and maybe a little bit about what's going on at the moment and where we're sitting with it as well. We know that a link between the synagogue and Israel perhaps is the word Beit Knesset, which is the same word used to name the Israeli parliament, which is having so much press and so much conversation about at the moment, about laws that are trying to be passed, the threat to democracy now and potentially up until now. And it's the name of a synagogue as well. So there's a kind of connection there about what we do when we gather as Jews. And, you know, 75 years ago, the establishment of the State of Israel, we're in quite a different place as we are. Reformed Jews hold a certain type of relationship towards Israel around the ideals of democracy, social cohesion, repair, and hope, maybe, although that feels harder and harder to hold on to because of the conflict, because of the bloodshed, and because of the polarized conversations here in Britain around Israel and how hard it is to have these conversations. So we'll all have seen the news recently about people taking to the streets for the Choose Democracy, really in a way that we haven't seen quite so extremely, or with people taking to the streets, with people here in Britain talking and taking to the streets as well, resisting the attempts of Netanyahu's ultra-right-wing coalition to push through changes to the judiciary to threaten the core of Israeli democracy.
And we've really seen people coming from across the divide to some extent. I think the difficulty in having these conversations is that it is, as you said, Robin, so polarizing so much of the time. And actually, a lot of the time I'm trying to have these conversations outside the Jewish community, which brings its own challenges as well. But when we saw people protesting, particularly in Israel, but also in London this week, their motto was that left and right are not going to hate each other and we're going to make this change together. And that it's a fascinating challenge around what democracy is, because the way that the democratic process works in Israel is these tiny parties that are really radical actually end up holding quite a lot of power, so that no one really feels like they've elected the people who are there to some extent.
It's interesting in terms of when we can feel that our voices can be heard as well, because there is a question about what is the democracy that we are trying to preserve. And it's a little bit like a lot of Jewish conversations, I suspect, that often we use language that we don't necessarily have a shared kind of translation of. The shorthand works for all of us. And yet, what does it look like to be saying we're trying to preserve democracy? What does that democracy then look like across the board? And I think all of these nuances, you know, are so hard that it does, you know, I was joking earlier about kind of keeping steering us away, but it's that feeling of, can you ever find the language once you start unpacking it? That actually is the shared language, because it's the nuance, it's the detail that seems to be so hard.
Yeah. And I think that is one of the problems that I've seen when trying to have conversations around Israel, that before you've even started, there's a sense of like defensiveness and anger about the assumptions that are being made, the experience that some people that have had. And I think there's a lot of kind of fear and a lot of anger behind it. And it's such a shame, isn't it? Because I think that if we were able to have some of these conversations, we'd also be able to have more hope about the situation. But often, because I feel that sometimes we can't even have the conversations within our British communal spaces, how can it even get to a point where there is hope if we can't even have a conversation about it from afar? I don't know if you saw the Jews Don't Count documentary with David Baddiel, and he had a conversation with Miriam Margolyes, who I love, and they were having a conversation about British Jews' relationship to Israel. And he was making the point that many people make around anti-Semitism, that just because I'm Jewish does not mean that I am responsible, which is true, for the Israeli government, or that I should actually have an opinion about Israel. And that is often a very mainstream line, and one that I agree with to a point. I don't believe we're responsible for the Israeli government. But Miriam Margolyes made the point that we are connected, and it's foolish to think otherwise, that actually, you know, we do have a connection in some way by being Jewish, and that is a homeland where loads of Jews are. And it was a really interesting conversation, and it helped me tease out, like, how should I talk? I'm even stuttering talking about it. Like, how do I talk about it? Should I be talking about it? How do I have this conversation in a way that's constructive and helpful? The thing that I did, this is just pre-COVID, was I went on an amazing tour all around the region with the CCJ, the Council of Christians and Jews. I don't know if either of you have done that tour. Highly, highly recommend it. Everyone I've gone on really talks highly of it. It was so nuanced and reflective and heard such diverse voices. Like, we went to the West Bank, we went all over to Jerusalem, all the different places, conversations with interfaith leaders. And it was a space I hadn't been in before because it allowed the nuance, it allowed reflection, it allowed emotion. It was hope, it was despair. You know, is the two-state solution even viable anymore? We spoke to journalists. And actually that gave me hope only because I was in a space where we were actually talking constructively and we could hear each other actually from across divides. And that was a very powerful experience.
I think my childhood gave me a great step into this conversation, which is my childhood came from a place of love of Israel, right? I went to Jewish kindergarten and Jewish primary school, and the nuances of Israel, I don't remember being taught at that time ever. Israel was simply a place where we were celebrated. The whole of our 7 years at Akiva was kind of with this goal in mind of like, why do we learn Hebrew every day? Because at the end of year six, you get to go on this trip to Israel. And it was so much focused in that really positive way. I mean, I even remember the year I went to live in Israel, being shocked that it did actually get cold in the winter, because like this picture postcard image of like Israel that had given to me as a child never really focused even on like, you know, it does actually get cold sometimes. It was to that extent a positive picture. And I was really aware that when Ben was little, you know, not being at a Jewish primary school and being part of a community where we're often kind of having some of the difficult conversations around Israel, Johnny and I made a concerted effort. We need to take him on holiday just to fall in love with Israel. Like this is our aim for this holiday. And as we arrived at the airport, there were announcements being made about reminding people that guns were not allowed on the, you know, in the airport, whatever it's called, like site. And, you know, his first thing as a little boy was, wow, look at all the soldiers that are around and look at all the guns and all of this. And it was so interesting of like immediately that conversation was kind of thrown into the mix of like, why are there so many guns? What's the kind of conversation around security going to be? And it's hard because I think the conversation is an easier conversation to have when you've come at the conversation from a place of love.
I didn't grow up in Jewish schools, but in RSY Netzer and at synagogue, I think there were definitely criticisms of Israeli government made by my rabbi, and I'm certainly aware of debates, but there was also this kind of sense of course we are Zionist, of course we support the state of Israel, even though we might not love everything that happens there. And I think it was probably only about a decade ago that I started to realize that in places in the UK, Zionism is a slur. It's an attack word against us. And doing a lot of dialogue work. So I went on a trip, not dissimilar to yours, Robin, but organised by St. Ethelberger's Centre for Reconciliation and Peace, with 4 Muslims, 4 Christians and 4 Jews, travelling around Israel, the West Bank, visiting peace projects, but also people who, you know, live in refugee camps and people who live in settlements, and, you know, just really listening to everyone's stories. And one amazing Christian colleague who I still do a lot of work with, who'd chosen to come on the tour because he was very engaged in the Free Palestine movement and really wanted to hear the other side. He felt he'd not exposed himself to the other side. And I now go in and talk with he organises interfaith training for clergy. And the first couple of years I went, he said to me specifically, you have to tell them that you're a Zionist, but do it towards the end when they've started liking you, which was a bit of an assumption. But like that sense that because they understand Zionism as such a negative thing, to hear nuanced Zionism, to hear Zionism that wrestles and that loves Israel, but also struggles with Israel, was an important part of the learning. So I try to be really honest now with the groups and say that the way I talk about things can be really changeable depending on what the person I'm talking to says, because I tend to almost always be deliberately argumentative. Whether you're coming from the right or the left, I will argue the opposite because there's so much grey and I can see so much on both sides. And even though I know I would situate myself further to the left, I find myself saying things that my grandfather would say, who Gary used to just drop Israel into the conversation to watch us explode against each other. And that's often how it is for families, right? There are these polarizing views. But actually, I think having talked for years about how being a Zionist doesn't necessarily mean I support everything the Israeli government does. It also doesn't mean that I don't think Palestinians have a right to self-determination and to live in peace and security. there is a sense of pride now that Israelis are standing up and protesting on such a large scale. They're doing it in London, they're doing it in Israel. And I hope it is the beginning of a move to change and to allow, I mean, look, we always joke that you can criticize Israel in Israel much more than anywhere else, right? The Israelis have a very open, deep dialogue about the challenges of living in Israeli society, much more than we sometimes are able to here. But hopefully that dialogue is moving across the board now and not just in its little pockets of conversation.
There is something very powerful at seeing such mass movement. And we know that there, you know, there have been activists doing amazing work for a better situation there. And when it's interesting, because we've used the term sides, you know, on that side, on this side. And it reminds me of the work of the charity Solutions Not Sides, which is really amazing. Powerful. And it's, again, changing the language, but not only the language, the framework of how we talk about these things, of changing it from them and us to, and where are we brought together? We had a event at Jackson's Row before COVID, pre-COVID, at BC. And that was so powerful because two young activists from different backgrounds whose, you know, family, it's a Palestinian woman whose family had been killed. It was a young Israeli activist. And they came together and they spoke. And it was the most powerful thing to see them having those conversations, as painful as they were, but they'd chosen to be in that space together as part of their activism. And that gives great hope as well. And like, we're seeing, you know, these big protests now putting into action a different, more public conversation. And I guess, you know, the challenge for us is getting involved not only in this threat at the moment to the particular democracy that's there, and also to progressive Judaism, because, you know, ironically, it's one of the hardest places to be a progressive Jew, you know, not being able to get married. There's now a threat about our conversion candidates or people who have converted being recognised from the state. I guess there's a challenge to us about adding our voice to this fight and more, you know, like maybe this is a way to get involved into the bigger picture, to start creating the kind of Israel or the kind of space, and, you know, whether that's a one state, two state, or however that looks, to make sure it's a place of fairness, of equality, of repair, of honest conversation, that it, maybe it's a gateway for us to step further into that rather than shying away because it's just too difficult.
And I think that's what excites me most, that actually it's the security question that seems to always dominate conversations around Israel. And that's what polarizes people, because it's about it's the question about treatment of Palestinians so often is thrown back as a security question. And actually what the conversation is opening up at the moment is a conversation around different minority groups within Israel and a need for democracy for everybody, whether that's the LGBTQ community, whether that's the progressive Jewish community. This is opening up the question for minorities. And I hope that there will be scope for people who have never raised their kind of head above the parapet, and maybe that's us too, that say, now I'm able to find my voice because there's a minority that I do speak for. You know, it's my converts, it's my colleagues in Israel that are not allowed to perform weddings, that we then elevate our voices to be part of a conversation around everybody's need for democracy, you know, across the whole population.
One of the most powerful things I heard from Solutions Not Sides speakers was both young activists saying, don't tell me you're pro-Israel, or don't tell me you're pro-Palestine, because that means you want us to stay locked in this situation. Mm-hmm. Tell us you are pro-solution. Mm-hmm. And it was such a hopeful message of, you know, it's not about taking a side. It's about finding a livable solution where everybody is heard and honoured. And one of the most hopeful things that I saw when I was on March of the Living last year was the Arab Unity Party from Israel were there in the March of the Living, listening to that Jewish story of the Shoah and holding their banner with pride as Arab Israeli politicians. And their ability to be present in our space of pain is such a powerful reminder of how we all need to sit and be hearing each other's space of pain in order to work towards that solution and hope.
You two were strangers in the land.
That's so powerful, isn't it? And that is, we know that coming across divides together in our particular struggles of pain is where the power lies and where change happens. Like, instead of us all being, I'm kind of talking more generally, I guess, than just Israel and Palestine now, but like, rather than being stuck in our own story and someone else's story being a threat to ours, to actually realize that we intersect and that, you know, the oppression that we've had or the violence that we've endured over the years actually is under an umbrella. Like, we need to come together for that. And it's really powerful when that can happen and we can have those conversations.
But isn't that not the like absolute essence of Torah? Like, I think Judaism has been misrepresented when it's about the halachic nuances of Jewish practice. Like, actually, when you read Torah, the overriding message is know your story, know who you are, so that you can go out into the world and treat everyone with the empathy that comes from knowing your story and knowing where you've come from. All the halachic nuances and how to practice being Jewish are all ways of creating community. If we could create an Israel where those two pillars were able to sit together rather than the politics ending up being controlled by the nuanced practice rather than the overall image.
Yeah. I think as we're coming to the end of our episode, maybe it's also coming out of that point that we're in this moment between Purim and Pesach. And we spoke about Dr. Jeremy Schonfield's teaching about Purim being that kind of teenage sense and Passover being an adult way of being able to deal with these stories of oppression and pain and slavery and freedom. And actually, like, our conversations around Israel can be so Purim. You know, we can't tell the difference between Haman and Mordechai. We're kind of trapped in that sense. God certainly isn't in the conversation. It's just about facts and, you know, our own experience. And in Pesach, we're able to sit around a table with through ritual. We spill the blood, we recognize the pain, we can hear the story. And as you said, we step into, we're slaves in Egypt. What does that mean to you today? And maybe that's, you know, that's our ideal, that we have a Seder table rather than a kind of chaotic, drunken Purim carnival in these conversations. So there we go. Should we end on a kind of high, if we can, towards Nissan, towards freedom and liberation? And hopefully our conversation, you know, there's always a risk with these things. We're very aware of having a conversation about something that is so bland because we're being so careful. But I think we've been able to talk to some of the something within it. And maybe there's more conversation to be had. Well, there certainly is. So I'm going to really miss having our like fortnightly catch-ups in this way. So please, as well as doing what you need to in your activist world, make sure to send a letter into Movement for Reform Judaism for season 3. Have a wonderful Pesach. Have a great few weeks and months until we see you next. It's been lovely to be with you all. And that's a wrap for our 36th episode of Rabbiting On. Bye.
Bye. Bye.